happy to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Zach Torgerson. He is working in Omaha with Colon and Rectal Surgery, Inc. at Creighton University and the University of Nebraska. And following abscess, we of course have to talk about an anal fistula, the road less traveled.
Pleasure to be here with you all this morning. I have no disclosures. So we're going to be speaking about fistulas, specifically the history, assessment, management, and then some emerging therapies at the end. So starting off with the history, this is King Louis XIV, also known as the Sun King. And he was unfortunate enough in 1686 to develop an anterior abscess. At this point in time, surgeons were not held in very high regard, so his physicians initially drained his abscess. He did not improve at all, and he was unable to conduct any of his state business or personal affairs. He was also unable to ride his horse, which was very irritating to him. They attempted several injections, as well as hot iron cauterization and application of some burgundy-soaked leaves without any success. After this all failed, he turned to his barber surgeon, Charles Francois Felix. So he had no prior fistula experience, and he decided before operating on the king that he should gain some experience. So over the next several months, he went around to all the local villages as well as the prisons, found anybody with anorectal complaints, and honed his craft. He developed his own tools. As you see, one of his tools there is on the right. That's a fistulotomy probe and a scalpel that he used. It's actually on display now at the Museum of Medical History in Paris. So on November 18th, he performed a three-hour operation and was successful. For his operation, he received land title and status, and surgery was elevated as a profession in France. The king actually appointed a training center at Versailles, and the Royal Academy of Surgery was started by his grandson in 1731. Now fast forward several centuries, and we'll talk a little bit about the assessment of fistulas today. So as we already kind of touched on, the etiology is important, location, the type or classification of the fistula, its complexity, and then some patient-specific factors, including age, gender, continence, prior surgical history, and obstetrical history are all important. As was mentioned in the first talk, the vast majority of these are cryptoglandular, 9 out of every 10. But it's important to remember that other things can cause fistulas, including inflammatory bowel disease, radiation, malignancy, various infections, including sexually transmitted infections, trauma, obstetrical injuries, and iatrogenic fistulas. In 1900, David Henry Goodsall described Goodsall's rule, which I'm sure is learned by every medical student, delineating anterior versus posterior tracts separated by the transverse anal line. Unfortunately, this has been shown to be inaccurate, especially for anterior fistulas. Greater than 70% of patients with an anterior fistula tract actually tracts to the midline instead of in a radial fashion, as was originally described. And greater than 80% of all patients with fistulas track to either the anterior or the posterior midline. Classification of fistulas, this is a modified Parkes classification. So as you can see here, the most two common are intersphincteric and transphincteric, involving just the internal and external sphincters respectively. Supersphincteric and extrasphincteric fistulas are less common, again, as was mentioned briefly in the first talk. Things we look for in terms of determining whether a fistula is complex would be high transphincteric, extra or supersphincteric fistula associated with inflammatory bowel disease, radiation, malignancy. Recurrent fistulas, especially fistulas that appeared to be straightforward initially, anterior fistulas in women, and patients with impaired continence. Imaging is often unnecessary for the simple or straightforward fistula. It can be very helpful in patients that have had recurrences or where the anatomy is unclear, such as patients with a horseshoe extension or possibly a high blind tract, as well as fistulas that extend into adjacent structures. Fistulography, MRI, and endoanal ultrasound are all used. And MRI has been demonstrated to improve outcomes, especially for recurrent fistulas, particularly when reviewed with a reading radiologist prior to surgery. As you can see here on the right, this demonstrates a picture of an endoanal ultrasound with injection of hydrogen peroxide to better delineate the tract. Management of fistulas includes several different procedures. First is a fistulotomy, seton placement, endorectal advancement flap, fibrin glue or fistula plug, and ligation of intersphincteric fistula tract. The first question is when to perform a fistulotomy. Can it be performed at the time of the initial abscess drainage? This would potentially decrease the need for secondary procedures. However, acute inflammation may make it difficult for an accurate assessment of sphincter involvement, which may lead to increased likelihood in disturbances incontinence. And also, we know that only 30 to 40% of abscesses ultimately result in the fistula. This is a Cochrane review by Malik et al., which helps us answer this question. So they looked at two specific things. The first is they compared patients that had fistulotomy at the time of abscess drainage with those that did not, and compared whether or not they required repeat operation. There was a significant difference in patients that did not have a fistulotomy performed at the first operation. The second thing that they looked at was continence 1 year after the operation, and they found that there was no difference in continence between patients that had a fistulotomy at the time of surgery versus those that did not. So this should be taken with some caution. There were 6 studies. Several of them were relatively small, and they were heterogeneous in terms of the patients that were included, the types of fistulas, and the techniques that were used. And the authors did mention in their conclusions that our findings should not be applied to patients with high or supersphincteric anal fistulae or other groups. By other groups, they essentially mean complex fistulas. The American Society of Colon and Rectal Surgery practice parameters state that concomitant fistulotomy with incision and drainage may be considered in some select patients with anorectal abscess and fistula. Fistulotomy is a standard treatment for intersphincteric or low transphincteric fistulas. Tract is opened over a probe with or without marsupialization. Recurrence is low, 5 to 7%. Is commonly reported, and incontinence is very low as well. Setons can be placed at this time for unexpected higher complex fistulas. Endorectal advancement flap is a full thickness flap, and by full thickness, this means mucosa, submucosa, and part of the internal sphincter rather than just a mucosal flap. It's important to note that when conducting this operation, the width of the flap should be 2 to 3. The width of the base of the flap should be 2 to 3 times that of the apex. It's important to mobilize the flap 4 to 6 centimeters proximal to the internal opening so that it can be closed without tension. The flap is then elevated, and the internal opening is closed in the internal sphincter, and then the flap is secured. Unfortunately, recurrence rates are variable, anywhere from 0 to 60%. Most studies with long-term follow-up demonstrate recurrence in 30 to 40% of patients. This is a study performed looking at patients that have had failure after an initial endorectal advancement flap, specifically looking at whether or not a repeat flap can be performed. They had 97 patients initially, 24 failed, and 9 were treated with repeat flap, 7 of which were ultimately successful. As you can see, one of the 2 failures was a mucosal flap, and the other failure actually failed 3 separate flaps. I think the most important thing to glean out of this study is that 5 out of the 9 patients that underwent repeat flap did have changes in their continence. Fistula plug we'll touch on just very briefly. This is a porcine small intestinal submucosal graft. It acts as a collagen scaffold. There's no risk of incontinence as it's simply placed into the fistula rather than cutting any muscle. Unfortunately, healing occurs in well less than 50% of patients. As you can see on the right, this is a comparison by Christofrades et al. Of endorectal advancement flap versus fistula plug. The flap is much more successful than the plug, and all recurrences occurred in the first year. finally, ligation of intersphincteric tract. This was initially described in 2007. It's a sphincter-preserving approach. Circumferential dissection is performed of the fistula in the intersphincteric groove, followed by ligation of the tract proximally and distally with division of the fistula. Closure is confirmed by a hydrogen peroxide injection. This is a busy slide, but it's only meant to demonstrate that there have been multiple studies on the lift with variable results yet again. The initial series demonstrated a success rate of 95%. As you can see, some studies report success rates as low as 39%. We do now have 10-year data from the authors, from the original authors of the lift procedure. They report 87% primary healing, 99% overall healing, and most importantly, 45% of their patients who underwent a lift that did develop a recurrence developed an intersphincteric recurrence, which could be treated with fistulotomy. Only 35% ultimately developed a true recurrent transphincteric fistula requiring a repeat lift operation. This is just a schematic of the recurrences in their series. As mentioned previously, 14 of their patients were able to undergo fistulotomy, of which 13 promptly healed. Those patients that had a repeat lift performed, five healed, while six underwent further surgeries before ultimately healing. And finally, just to touch on perianal Crohn's disease, up to one-third of Crohn's patients will develop perianal disease. Initial management includes drainage of sepsis with placement of a seton so that the patients can be started on medical management. Medical management with anti-TNF-alpha agents is preferred, and this has been reported to have 30 to 55% healing of fistulous disease. These studies are a little bit variable in terms of what they define as healing and their follow-up. For patients wishing to undergo surgical repair in whom their fistulas have not healed, proctitis must be eliminated prior to any surgical repair. We try to do everything we can to discourage these patients from undergoing surgery due to their risk of incurrence of incontinence and wound healing complications. This is a situation where fibrin glue or plugs may be a useful first step. This is simply a schematic demonstrating that in patients that have active proctitis from their Crohn's disease, they are candidates only for seton placement, proximal diversion, and proctectomy, whereas patients who have no proctitis ultimately can undergo fistulotomy or other associated procedures after they've been adequately counseled as to their risks. Finally, just in terms of some of the future therapies that are currently being investigated, stem cells are an area of intense investigation now for fistulous disease in perianal Crohn's. Initial outcomes are encouraging, certainly better than current medical management, but these are clinical trials. More data is hopefully coming. Thank you very much.